Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And, you know, there's a lot of things that I have not even touched on the show as far as content goes. There's a lot of challenges to the Constitution. As a matter of fact, we're going to find that it's only going to get worse. That's why I keep saying that it's now or never. We do have Paul back. And so welcome back, Paul.
Hey, GR. Thank you.
So which means it's going to be real content day. And I'm not sure if you listened to yesterday's show with the Billy Graham letter, but there are people that are so, I mean, they're willing to die to subjugate us. In other words, they really believe that what is, and they have no idea that most of these people, they are going to die if, you know, the globalists get their way. Mm-hmm. And what this means, folks, is that, you know, the pandemic, I really don't want to go down the rat hole of religion and all of that, but I do. And it really comes down to connecting the dots, reading Revelations. There is a large amount of people that are going to die. And so we have a choice of trying to make sure that the population of America may not be included in that. And we're not doing a good job. What do you think?
It's a really uncomfortable thing to think about. I've been through the book of Revelation a few times, and it, in a way, it saddens me because it seems like many of us are simply, and by the way, I don't have head big enough to think, hey, I'm going to make it. All I'm just saying is it's going to be a bloodbath. Okay. And so one of the reasons I'm doing what I'm doing is because I really want to limit the bloodshed that is coming. I guess that's the best way I can put it. I don't think I can stop it because, you know, the Lord has decreed that, you know, there's going to be a cleanup.
Right, right.
And so I guess what drives me is that I love people. I love the Lord's work. And I want to be engaged in it for, you know, to save as many as I can.
Right.
Okay. Well,
the bringing this back in, I don't think that I don't think we necessarily have to suffer, but, you know, I'm not seeing, and it's unfortunate because I had a call with the Georgia folks last night, and they were talking about Anna Von Ritz and, you know, these sovereign citizen movements and so forth. And anyway, putting all that aside, because there are a lot of patriots. I mean, if you really look at out of the, let's just say, the Republicans, you know, people that align on the conservative side, is it safe to say that maybe about 30%? Is it safe?
What?
Because when you look at the voting and you look at how, you know, the turnout of voters and so forth, because we got a lot of people in America that are indifferent. And so I think 30% of the population is, you know, going to be, sorry, we lost you there, Paul. You beeped out on me, so I'm not sure
yes,
if you heard me.
Yes, I did hear that.
And
I heard you say looked at the voting, and then I lost what you said, so
yes.
I apologize.
Oh, okay, so when we look at the voting outcome over the past several decades, we see that it's somewhere around 60% voter turnout, something like that, you know, nationwide.
Right.
And so if that's the case, then the people that are on the conservative camp, let's just say we kind of divide that in half, or it's kind of close to that, because that's how the elections have been long before they even got corrupted. Now, venturing to say, if you look at 30%, I mean, so that is, what, 90 million people?
Yeah.
Roughly.
30%? Yes, about 90 million people.
Right. Okay, 90, so roughly.
9 million.
And yeah. Out of that 90 million people, I would probably say that you have a small percentage of that who are really, I would just say, you know, hard activist or hard, you know, conservatives, those who are, you know, active in the Republican Party, you know, if going down these paths of activism. So I would venture to say, you know, that would be maybe 9 million people, maybe 10. Let's just round it up to 10.
Okay.
That are active in all of the different efforts, whether it's a Libertarian Party, Constitution Party, all these other different grassroots that are just out there. And out of that 10%, out of the 10%, because we're including the Republican Party and all of this, you know, now what is the percentage of that 10% that are activists? What's the percentage of that really understands the Constitution?
I don't know if as much as 1%, GR.
Well, so out of the 10%, let's just say out of 10 million, out of 10 million, out of the 10 million, because actually, technically, that is 10 million is around 3% of the population, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so out of the 3%, how much of that group really understands the Constitution?
I don't know. Maybe 10% of that group at best is my guess.
So my point.
You think it's more?
Well, so that would be 1 million. And, you know, I think I think there's 1 million that kind of understands the Constitution, but I think it's even a smaller group than that, that really understands. So if we break it down to the degrees of understanding, you know, obviously I don't have 1 million people listen to this show. Because okay. I believe that the people that listen to the show and actually bear through the content of what we cover. And today what we're going to start is we're going to go through Republic Review and we're going to go through how James Madison, actually Thomas Jefferson, kicked this off. And I don't have any evidence of this, but there had to have been a coordinated effort. And I'll explain why and how when you look at what happened in the background. But there's no doubt in my mind when the Alien and Sedition Acts got passed in 1798, it was around the July timeframe. Madison and Jefferson sat down and they were very concerned with what was going to happen because they were basically creating laws that would go after political speech and going after people who were friends of radicals to be able to deport them and all these other things when the federal government didn't have that power yet. And so at that point in time, they probably had a very, very small percentage of the people, just like we're looking at today. They have a minuscule amount of people that really understood the Constitution. For the most part, the people didn't, you know, they've probably read maybe the Constitution. They're familiar a little bit with it, but they didn't have this profound understanding. They obviously didn't even understand the principles. And I'll even go as far as to say the framers who were involved in the Constitutional Convention did not understand some aspects of what they were doing. And I say this because I'm sitting here looking right now. It's in my face. The notes, Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I'm reading through the day of, which is June 11th, the day of the Sherman Compromise. And so when you understand what the Sherman Compromise really put on the table, it expanded republicanism in America to shift away from representatives of the people. It expanded the concept of suffrage of the people. It actually opened the door to give suffrage to the sub element of government, that government that is, you know, in league with the people at that level. In other words, at the federal level, it was the states that were in league with the people. And so the legislative body in the federal government shares the suffrage of the states and shares the suffrage of the people in the two respective houses. And they partitioned the legislative powers to grant very specific powers, roles, responsibilities to the Senate, and completely different roles and responsibilities to the House of Representatives. And that exact same model should have been applied, and in a way it was applied in the very early states. But as the older this nation became and how little people understood, that became the problem. Because people were then instituting government thinking this is a great thing, and it was a great thing, but they weren't doing it right. And there is a right way to doing this, and there's a right way to fix things. And so back to the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, this is the process of basically corralling government and getting it back into the framework it needs to be. Now, there's a lot of work that needs to be done at the county level. That's really where our focus has to be. But the whole point is we need to cover all of this content. And and so what we're going to do is we're going to open up the Kentucky resolutions. And so in response to the congressional laws that were passed, the Alien and Sedition Acts, what we're looking at is a resolution or a set of resolutions that were penned by Thomas Jefferson. And as a matter of fact, I'll read kind of the little precursor to this. The following resolutions were adopted by the Kentucky legislature on 10 November 1798 as a protest against the Alien and Sedition Acts passed by Congress. They were authored by Thomas Jefferson, but he did not make public the fact until much later. It just says later years. So, but anyway.
Right. So if you permit me, I'd like to add something to what you're saying, because the idea of this shared suffrage is such a novel concept that I don't think they got it right away.
I'll even go as beyond this. I think that they saw the compromise as a balancing effect, because in the Continental Congress, each state had equal voice, and they said that's problematic. And they said, so we need to actually give apportionment to the people. And so that would have been problematic, too. Both paths of, because look at Britain. Britain is only suffrage of the people. And so, and they looked at, you know, the Roman Empire, which was the suffrage of the Senate. In other words, each state had an equal voice. And there were always problems. And creating this balance and dividing the powers was well beyond the framers' comprehension.
Right.
I think that, go ahead.
I think it was. But what I think is that, and you have to remember, Jefferson wasn't even in the United States when the Constitution was. He was, I think, ambassador to France at the time. But I think he and Madison had, here's what I understand, that he and Madison continually corresponded through the entire time. And I think the two of them understood this probably better than anyone. And so they're trying to start something here. And what they've done, the good news is that they've given us the precedent, even though the sister states at the time, I don't think they got it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I know.
In other words, like you point out all the time, the divine hand of providence has given us this pattern. And even though the other states didn't get it, we've got the outline.
Right.
We've got the blueprint to make this work. And so that's the comment I wanted to make before we got too far, you know.
Okay.
If that's okay.
No, that's absolutely okay. So it's always been about suffrage, but what's really important, and this is, I'm trying to articulate this in why counties matter most. For, you know, for the annals of history, of mankind, the histories and of governments, as much as we can comprehend, the struggle has always been this concept of, and you were actually talking about this before we started recording, regarding a Bill of Rights or adding something to the state constitution, which was a right of it was consent, but actually, so frame it for me again.
So here's what happened. There is a someone's proposing a bill for informed consent. This has to do with health freedom.
Right.
All right. Okay. And I'm making a response to this because I don't think this is the direction to go. We already have a right in the Missouri Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, okay, to life, liberty, and property. And if we're being forced to do something against our will, our liberty is being challenged, and we need to pursue that in a different direction.
And potentially your life. Right. So the informed consent. So this is what I wanted to get into, because the lure of democracy is a very strong tonic. As a matter of fact, it is the siren song that gets everybody to think, yes, if we all have an equal voice, then we will get the government that is best. And actually, every time, and the history proves this, that every time the people invoke a pure democracy, they, I'll just say anarchy basically, you know, follows, because eventually it'll be about the, and democracy in essence is the most carnal state of government that you can have, because you're literally chasing the whims and desires of the people. And this is where Tytler's cycle of democracy comes in, that you get to a point where there is a conscious, acknowledgement that we're going to kill the goose that lays the golden egg so that we can have something to eat. And in other words, we kill, you know, our future. We basically, and this is what we're seeing in mortgaging, you know, supposedly, legitimately, they want everybody to believe this is legitimate, by mortgaging our future by taking more and more and more debt. And so, and we see this playing out right now. I mean, they keep on talking. This has been the repeating song. And this is because we have basically put aside our Republican form of government and have embraced democracy. And the Constitution doesn't allow this. But the point, my point is coming back to this, is the perfect government is a government that is disciplined on the law and actually has these barriers and safety nets. And when you really look at what the Constitution gives us, it gives us these barriers. It gives us this division and separations of power that are actually, you know, guides that keep us on the road, that keeps us from actually falling off at our own demise. Because as soon as you give any species enough rope, they're going to hang themselves. And that's an old adage, but that's what we're seeing playing out here. We're seeing America with all of this rope to say, you know, we can buy this paradigm of Woodrow Wilson, buying ourselves into this prosperity. And you beeped out on me again, but this paradigm of being able to buy ourselves into prosperity is a failed paradigm, And so what I want to do is dive into this and understand the importance that we, the people, have. Just like the states. See, the states have the responsibility of holding our federal government accountable. The counties have the responsibility of holding your states accountable. We, the people, have the accountability and responsibility of holding our government accountable. And the most important government is our county government, because once we actually have people that are going to be full-time warriors and, you know, in demanding the compliance to the Constitution at our local level, that actually cleans, it starts sweeping through your counties and through your state, and then eventually we clean up the state. And so the only way we're going to effectively clean up the state is not by going through the old processes of just trying to elect Republicans or good people, conservatives. It is all about compliance to the Constitution and holding them accountable. The only way the federal government is going to behave is when the states hold them accountable. The only way the states are going to behave is when the counties hold them accountable. And the only way the counties are going to behave is when the people hold them accountable.
Right.
And so this is the end run. And unfortunately, I started here, folks. It all started in how do we really solve this problem? And the reason why this was so big to me, and it still is our biggest mess, is if the federal government falls, the world falls with it. Mm-hmm. If your state falls, you know, then there's a lot of counties and people that will be affected. If your county falls, it's, you know, it's bad. There's still a lot of people, but not to the magnitude of your state. So in other words, the gravity and the magnitude of failure at the county level is not as significant. And this is why nobody even noticed that the failure of your county had already occurred, that they had already basically obviated your representation, and they basically had moved the counties into an administrative function instead of actually being your representatives. And so that's why I'm working on this article. This is a key article that people really need to start sinking their teeth into and understanding how the federal government had a direct involvement in basically perverting the state's Republican form of government. Now, with that, all this as a prelude to diving into this. So we're going to get into this because we only got less than 3 minutes to do the first reading. And then when we come back, we'll try to really focus on all of this. And I'm just going to try to continually connect the dots that what they're doing here is the same thing we have to do at the county level. And so with that, go ahead.
So let's start with number one resolve.
You
right?
bet. Go ahead.
Okay. That the several states composing the United States of America are not united on the principle of unlimited submission to their general government, but that by a compact under the style and title of a constitution for the United States and of amendments thereto, they constituted a general government for special purposes, delegated to that government certain definite powers, reserving each state to itself the residuary mass of rights to their own self-government. That's a new word for me.
Which one?
Residuary.
In other words, the residual.
Right.
So what he just said here, we're not even done with this first resolution. What he just did was he drew the line and said, look, this government is a limited government that the states composing of the United States are not united on the principle of unlimited submission to this general government. That by this compact under, you know, we call the Constitution and its amendments thereto, they constituted a general government for very special purposes, delegated to that government these definite powers, reserving each state to itself all residual rights and powers. And basically, I've just rephrased what you just said.
Sure. Okay. So okay. We've got a minute left. I think I can do the rest of it.
Okay.
Right?
Let's give it a shot.
You think I can?
Actually, let's not, because there may be some other points that I don't want to gloss over and then go straight into the break.
Right.
Let me just say this. What we're going to see, folks, and what we're going to expose to you is this concept of... Help me out here. The concept of auditing the compact. So what Thomas Jefferson is actually going to do is he's going to go through the Constitution in these next few resolutions after he kind of lays out this preface. He's going to go through and point out how each of these bills, each of these laws, violate what parts of the Constitution. In other words, it's an audit. And identify, well, this violates that. You can't do this because it's a legal contractual audit. And that places direct context to exactly what the Constitution really is. It's a compact. And by going through the compact, then we can actually see the effects of auditing it, how calling out all of its different violations and so forth. And so we're obviously going into a break. We'll be right back after this very specific message or promo. We'll be right back after this, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we're ready to now actually dive further into this. And so, folks, we've just started on Resolution 1 of the Kentucky Resolutions. And, Paul, we're ready to go.
We're ready to go.
Okay.
So we read the first part. Let me continue. And that whensoever the general government assumes undelegated powers, its acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force. That to this compact, each state acceded as a state and is an integral part, its co-states forming as to itself the other party. That the government created by this compact was not made the exclusive or final judge of the extent of the powers delegated to itself, since that would have made its discretion and not the Constitution the measure of its powers, but that as in all other cases of compact, among powers having no common judge, each party has an equal right to judge for itself as well of infractions as of the mode and measure of redress.
Okay.
It's a mouthful.
It is.
But I understand what he's saying.
Okay. Yeah. Well, good. I'm sure that a lot of people don't, though. And so first off, he says that whensoever the federal government assumes undelegated powers, he says its acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force. Here's the problem. When the states actually allow or go along with the federal government violating the Constitution, then what happens? I'll give you a case in point. If the federal government comes along and says, you know, we need to do this, and we're going to, and basically they throw money out to each state to say, we think that this is something we need to do. Like, you know, for, you know, there's a plague in the 1800s that, you know, is killing a lot of people. And so they step forward for the, you know, for preserving the health and protecting children. They provide some money for the children's health, and all of the states take this money. Well, obviously, they don't have the authority to do that. It obviously falls right into an act that's unauthoritative and technically should be void and of no force. But the states went ahead and said, yeah, we don't want to see our kids die. So now what?
So the states, what happens is the states either act out of ignorance of their power or else they're aligned with this design.
Well,
okay,
so
one or the other.
So.
Right.
What we're talking about is that the federal government is doing something it has no authority to do, and the states actually go along with it. At that point, the states have now created a problem that only they can clean up. See, at the very beginning, a state could actually, and if you get all of the states to basically stand up and say, like Obamacare, you can't do that. And instead of going into the federal court where it is rigged, where, of course, they're going to subject you to, you know, this law because they have no jurisdiction. They have no authority as a court to do that. But they do. And this is how it happens. And so then what? So what do you then do? And, folks, it's really easy. You have to convince the states to step in and say, you know what? We never gave you the authority to do this. You know, we were guiled. I mean, you lied to us or you deceived us, whatever. But bottom line, we're taking back our authority and basically saying we never gave it to you. You had no authority to do these things. You're done. Get back right. with, get thee behind me and get back into the framework of that Constitution.
Right. Okay.
Because bottom line, it's not like we're going to get a whip out and start beating the buildings of government. We have mm-hmm. to get the whip out and beat the public servants in way, and I'm speaking metaphorically, folks, in ways of holding them accountable according to the law, which fundamentally means that we're then going to remove these folks from office. We're going to ban them from office, and they'll never, ever be able to be in office again if they fail to do what we tell them to do. And as a matter of fact, we can even go beyond that, because if some of these people, I'll give you a good case in point. If you look at January 6th, where they locked out the people from the Capitol, and then they started, you know, holding people accountable and so forth, had the states actually stepped up and done mm-hmm. what they were supposed to do, you know, and actually said, okay, Congress, you violated our rights. You violated the fundamental rights of us and the people, our citizens. And mm-hmm. therefore, you know, we're going to wholesale get rid of you. Or mm-hmm. you undo what you did. You stop this, you know, this incarceration, this oppression that you're doing. And, you know, we will let you stay in office. However, we're going to do the due diligence and demand we know who made the decisions, because bottom line, we know that they didn't take it to the floor for both houses to vote on locking down the Capitol. Right. In other words, there were people that, you know, had no idea what was going on, and they just, okay, this is what we're doing, and yeah, we can do that. They had no idea, but there were people that actually did that and actually violated our rights, and those people, at a minimum, should be kicked out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we should have done. That's what we have to do. That's what our responsibility is, as we the people holding our county, and the counties holding our state, and our state holding the federal government accountable. You know, when we start, you know, it, the old saying, crap, you know, rolls downhill. When we mm-hmm. start really, you know, going on our county level, and we start saying, you know, either you represent us, either you get into their grill and you hold them accountable, or you're gone. Because right. what you're telling me is you're not going to support your oath. You're not going to fulfill your oath in supporting the Constitution. And therefore, we have no desire to keep you in office. And as a matter of fact, what we're doing is we're coming for you now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we need to do. So bottom line, as he goes on here, he basically talks about, you know, that it is the parties that have, the parties of the Constitution, which is the states, who have that ultimate stay. Our ultimate say that the federal government cannot be the exclusive judge, or it would basically be, or the measure of their power would be their own discretion, is what he's saying. And correct. So bottom line, the creature of the compact does not have the authority to say, I can do whatever I want. The creature, mm-hmm. the thing that has been created by the state's powers, by the powers of the states, only the states have the ability, and they have the responsibility. This is what Madison will get into when we do that. So anyway, just to make sure, that's why he's laying this out, that bottom line, whenever they do something, it is void and of no force. However, when we as the states allow them to do it, then the states now actually have to take a proactive measure in holding them right. accountable.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So you had something that was illegitimate. The states went along with it, but that wasn't legitimate either. So now the states recognize, here's a problem. We're going to take our role and audit this and hold you accountable. That's right. What it sounds like you're saying,
yep.
right?
Right. So,
okay.
Right. Go ahead.
All right. So number two, resolved that the Constitution of the United States, having delegated to Congress a power to punish treason counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States, piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the law of nations, and no other crimes whatsoever, and it being true as a general principle, and one of the amendments to the Constitution having also declared that, quote, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people, end quote. Therefore, the Act of Congress, passed on the 14th day of July 1798, and entitled, quote, an act in addition to the act entitled an act for the punishment of certain crimes against the United States, end quote, and as also the act passed by them on the blank day of June 1798, entitled, quote, an act to punish frauds committed on the Bank of the United States, end quote, and all their other acts which assume to create, define, or punish crimes other than those so enumerated in the Constitution are altogether void and of no force, and that the power to create, define, and punish such other crimes is reserved and of right appertains solely and exclusively to the respective states, each within its own territory.
Okay, so what he basically did at the very beginning, and I don't know if you recognize it, but what he did was he audited the Constitution. He goes, okay, they're creating a law that gives them jurisdiction of enforcement and punishment. And so he goes through the Constitution. He says, hold on here. You know, it seems to me that we've only delegated to Congress a power to punish treason, counterfeiting, and piracies on the and piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the law of nations, and no other crimes. So how can you create a crime and give yourself jurisdiction to this?
Wow.
And he says, the power's not delegated. Then he basically cites the 10th Amendment, says, the power's not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And so then he goes on to the next one, and he basically says, okay, so this, you know, act and is all, and basically he lays it all out that these laws that they've created are null and void and of no force. Now, he's not using the word nullification at all. He's basically saying that we don't have to follow these. Now, this is October, so at this point in time, you know, the federal government, they pass a bill, now they're out there trying to get everything in motion to hire people, get the people out to start enforcing this. And so what they're trying to do is they're actually trying to get all the states to basically stand up and say, you can't do this, and create the interposition to say, cease and desist, undo those acts. Those acts have no validity anywhere but the District of Columbia and the territories of the United States. They are not applicable to us, the states. We are sovereign states, and only the powers that we've delegated to you do you have the power to execute. And so as we kind of move forward and we look at, you know, the next resolution, he's going to start going through more and more of the powers, or more of these different bills, because there were four acts that they passed. And he's going to go through the names of these, and he's going to go through. So what we're going to see for the remainder until we get to about the sixth resolution is going to be basically more auditing of how this act violates this part of the Constitution. And folks, the audit is important. And this is why when you read the petitions that we're doing, we have to kind of audit, you know, the process of saying, you don't have the authority to do this. This is your jurisdiction. This is what you're allowed to do. And this means you can't do what you're doing because it's not within that realm. And so,
Okay,
so go ahead and dive into the third one.
This is number three, right?
Yep.
That it is true as a general principle and is expressly declared by one of the amendments to the Constitution that, quote, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people, end quote. and that no power over the freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, all lawful powers respecting the same did of right remain and were reserved to the states or the people, that thus was manifested their determination to retain to themselves the right of judging how far the licentiousness of speech and of the press may be abridged without lessening their useful freedom, and how far those abuses which cannot be separated from their use should be tolerated, rather than the use be destroyed. And thus also, hang on just a minute.
It's okay.
It's just a long paragraph.
So these are long sentences as well.
Right.
Okay.
Be destroyed. Okay. And thus also, they guarded against all abridgment by the United States of the freedom of religious opinions and exercises, and retained to themselves the right of protecting the same, as this state, by a law passed on the general demand of its citizens, had already protected them from all human restraint or interference, and that in addition to this general principle and express declaration, another and more special provision has been made by one of the amendments to the Constitution, which expressly declares that, quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, end quote, thereby guarding in the same sentence and under the same words the freedom of religion, of speech, and of the press, insomuch that whatever violated either throws down the sanctuary which covers the others, and that libels, falsehood, and defamation, equally with heresy and false religion, are withheld from the cognizance of federal tribunals. That therefore the act of Congress of the United States passed on the 14th day of July 1798, entitled, quote, an act in addition to the act entitled an act for the punishment of certain crimes against the United States, end quote, which does abridge the freedom of press, is not law, but is altogether void and of no force.
Okay. He's showing how this very specific act has violated these parts of the Constitution. And he does the same in, you know, the rest of these. So let's keep going and let's watch how he audits going through each of these. So he's basically proving how these acts and how Congress has blatantly violated their oath and the Constitution.
Okay. Number four, resolved that alien friends are under the jurisdiction and protection of the laws of the state wherein they are, that no power over them has been delegated to the United States, nor prohibited to the individual states, distinct from their power over citizens. And it being true as a general principle, and one of the amendments to the Constitution having also declared that, quote, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people, end quote, the act of the Congress of the United States passed on the day of July 1798, entitled, quote, an act concerning aliens, end quote, which assumes powers over alien friends not delegated by the Constitution, is not law, but is altogether void and of no force. Now, really quick.
Okay.
Here's a question. This implies that also aliens within our borders are subject to these rights.
Well, so hold on here. You've got to read the next resolution.
Okay.
All right.
Let's go.
There
Number
we go.
Five. Resolved that in addition to the general principle as well as the express declaration, the powers not delegated are reserved, another and more special provision inserted in the Constitution from abundant caution has declared that, quote, the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808, end quote. That this Commonwealth does admit the migration of alien friends, described as the subject of the said act concerning aliens, that a provision against prohibiting their migration is a provision against all acts equivalent thereto, or it would be nugatory, that to remove them when migrated is equivalent to a prohibition of their migration and is therefore contrary to the said provision of the Constitution and void. Okay. GR, this guy just twisted my brain.
Okay.
I like Jefferson a lot, okay?
Uh-huh.
But we're all going to need help with 4 and 5.
Okay, so you got to understand that after the Constitution, the states had full cognizance and sovereignty or full control over the migration, importation of people until 1808. That power was basically not delegated to the federal government until 1808. So in other words, the federal government said, even though we have this responsibility of the naturalization, you know, when you actually go to the Constitution and you look at, you know, the Bill of Rights, or not the Bill of Rights, but you go to Article 1, Section 8, and that they shall establish a uniform rule of naturalization. And so what that means is that they still had the responsibility of a uniform rule of what it took to become a citizen, but the importation and migration. So here's an interesting thing. They didn't include this as a power in Article 1, Section 8. It was included in a weird reservation or a constriction placed on the federal government that they couldn't have that power until 1808, which is why both of these are basically saying, hey, we have the right and you don't have the power to stop us from importing people. And then, you know, it goes down to, you know, the 1808 clause. You can't stop us and you can't start deporting these people until 1808.
Okay.
Because so, when you look at the aliens, an act concerning aliens, this was the federal government that said, if we don't like the aliens that you have, we're going to deport them.
Okay. So what I need to do, I think it's probably a good idea to have some background for people to know what the Alien and Sedition Acts had to say. Okay. And I think we're starting, criticism. I just think we're starting without that piece of information.
So I understand that, but actually that's not that it's necessarily relevant to understand, you know, the nuances that that distinguish between one strand of hair and another strand of hair. There's a separation, you know, like when you're looking at a photograph, the picture that we're really looking at is, what do you do when they pass something that they don't have the authority to do? And so Thomas Jefferson is basically in these two. He's saying the alien friends are under the jurisdiction and protection of the laws of the states we're in. And then he later on goes and says that you don't have the ability to basically stop us from importing people, nor can you deport them until, you know, that clause kicks in 1808 that you'll find in Article 1, Section 9. So he's just auditing and identifying where the powers are, who has the authority, and at this point in time, the federal government does not have the authority over the importation and the management of migrants and imported slaves or imported people for whatever purpose. So that it's just basically laying down how they didn't have this authority over that. I mean, you can go, by all means, folks, I don't want to not have you look at these things. It's just that it's not that relevant. What's relevant is how you have to call it out and identify whether they actually have that authority or not. And so when you kind of look at what they were doing, he's basically pointing out that they're saying, hey, you're finding threats. And so really what was going on is that the French, because you got to understand that the Federalists were really Francophiles. And the Anti-Federalists, or I should say, the Jefferson, the Republicans in America, because the Federalists of Liberty really became Francophiles, and then those who were the anti-Federalist big government folks were the Anglophiles. In other words, those people who had a preference towards the English people and the English government. And so there was, I don't know if you knew this, but there was a lot of, you know, pointing and, you know, say, look at, the, you know, look what's going on in France today. And everybody thought that the French Revolution, I mean, Jefferson thought it was great until all of a sudden they started cutting the heads off of everybody.
Well, that was going to be my question. In this timeline, when did the French Revolution really heat up?
It was pretty early on. By this point in time, Napoleon Bonaparte had already risen to power. And so there were still many people of liberty minded. As a matter of fact, I believe, I forget the guy who was a good friend of Jefferson. I think he was in America either at this point in time or he just went back to France after the revolution. And he was trying
to Democracy in America.
Not Alexis Alexander de Tocqueville. Not Alexis de Tocqueville. It was somebody else. You know I'm bad with names, but it was a guy that was very integral in bringing assistance and bringing forces to America to help us actually win the Revolutionary War. And anyway, I mean, they mentioned him a lot. They mentioned him a lot. And so he ends up, being here in America. There's a lot of French that have come to America at this point in time. And it was Congress's intent to actually identify, to, you know, start getting rid of these folks because they were aligning with the Republicans. They were perceived.
So those were the aliens that were being referred to.
Yes. And the friends, you know, the alien friends under the jurisdiction and protection of the laws of the states. Correct.
Okay.
So this had nothing to do with invaders, or this had nothing to do with slaves. It had everything to do with the states having the cognitive power over the allowing of the migration and importation of folks. And he's just basically going through the Constitution, you know, where are the powers? Do you possess this power? No, you don't. That's simple. Anyway, I appreciate the fact that, you know, we want to know all of the details. And by all means, the more details you understand, the more you start going, oh, okay. And it starts making a little more sense. But moving on to Resolution 6.
Real quick. Sure. Was the guy André Limousin? The French guy?
That may be right. That may be, I'm really bad with names. It doesn't necessarily ring a bell loudly, but it's like Fourgé or something like that.
Right. Jefferson wrote to someone, said he's the one that said ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country.
Yep. Well, we just ran out of time that fast. And so anyway, folks, I apologize. We're diving into the details. So when we come back tomorrow, we're going to dive into Resolution 6. Because as we get down here, Jefferson's basically going to call out the states of what they need to do. And that's why this is all important, and this is how it creates the falling of the dominoes. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.